Hi, this is John McEwen of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and you're listening to the other Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass. Now, the other Steve Martin, one plays the banjo and makes albums, and one plays music. This is the other one that plays music on his show. But I'm the only John McEwen in the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, that is. Check it out, johnmcewen.com.
All right, that was great. Good timing. John McEwen called in. John and I was just playing. Still gives me chills to hear from "Will the Circle Be Unbroken," where Merle and Travis and Doc Watson meet for the first time. What an unbelievable recording that is!
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to be there when that was happening. It was one of the plans of doing the album when my brother and I were putting the people together. Because the way it came about is I asked Merle one day, second week of June, if he'd record with the Dirt Band, he said, I'd be proud to. And about a week later, I asked Doc, he was playing the same club in Boulder, Colorado, and I said, we're going to be making a recording with Earl. We'd like you to be there. He goes, well, if I'm Earl's going to pick, I'll be there. and then Bill said that night on the phone, well, maybe I can get Merle Travis. And then we asked Earl if he could get maybe Bill Carter and Jimmy Martin. And then, about 3 weeks into that process, we kind of told the band that there was a project coming together. And they got all excited, because it was a step at a time. You know, it wouldn't have happened at all if it hadn't been for the fact that Jeff Hanna had picked the right songs to sing, and Jimmy Fadden was such a good harp player. All those elements, everybody had a contribution that made this happen. But one of them was when we had Some of Shelley's Blues and Bojangles and House of Pooh Corner on the radio, the record company were more likely to say, okay, that's what you're going to do? You know, as opposed to, like, can we make an acoustic album now that we've had some charts songs?
Yeah, how did you pull that off?
Well, my brother and I went into the record company and met with the president and told him we wanted to make this album with, at this point in time, it was now Merle, Doc, and Earl, and Jimmy Martin, and Maybell. We didn't have the bass player and fiddle player lined up yet. And didn't have Junior Husky. Well, that's a bass player. And anyway, it was just the guy said, well, you're so passionate about this, I'll put up the money. Because we had to have somebody put up the money. Which was $22,000 for the whole album.
Ooh.
All rooms, studio, hotel, tape, recording, paying people, and everything.
Don't you wish you could do one for $22,000 today?
Well, you can. One of the magic things about the album that made it work was instead of recording two multi-tracks, 16-track, we had there was a machine running on the first song. One of the first guys up was Merle Travis. And he got his first song in one take. And why do we have 16 tracks and we're only using five of them?
Okay. You know,
bass, harmonica, guitar, vocal, and two on the guitar stereo. And because it was being recorded two track at the same time, and that's when the decision was made just to go to, let's turn off the multi-track. Now the difference there is a roll of two track tape costs $30. A roll of 16-track tape costs $190, and you use five times as many because recording at 30 inches per second is only about 15 minutes per reel. So,
okay,
economically, it saved a lot of money.
Well, we
Pardon? Go ahead.
No, the album itself, and I wanted to get back to make sure everybody knows if they just tuned in that we're talking to John McEwen, and I will identify him first because it's easier to recognize John as a founding member, still a member of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. But what we jumped off on right away, which I didn't mean to get right to that album, but daggone it, the very first "Will the Circle Be Unbroken" album, that's what we're talking about. Just a phenomenal, it's a piece of history, John. I mean, it just
it is. You know. We were, and I'm not saying it's something that we did. Let's take all the people that we had on the album out of the picture. It would just be a Dirt Band album doing a bunch of cover songs.
Which wouldn't be bad. That wouldn't be too bad.
But, But when you added the people that made the form of music, Maybelle Carter saying things like, if you don't mind, I'd like to do Wild Wild Flowers in key of F.
Yeah.
I wanted to say, listen, lady, you wrote the song. We'll do whatever you tell us.
That's a great piece. I played that piece earlier. I've mixed pieces in as we got to this stage of the show. And there's the bits in between. The music is fantastic, but the conversation in between.
That was a tape recorder that was running all the time at 7.5 inches per second.
Wow.
So it didn't have to be changed but every 2 hours. And the thing about the album, that it was recorded in 6 days. From that time that I first asked Earl Scruggs if he'd record with the Dirt Band, was somewhere like this June 8th or something, and by August 8th we were done with the album.
Wow.
We went to the studio and recorded for 6 days. Most of the tracks were first take. For the bluegrass pickers out there, Earl had to do 7 takes on Flint Hill Special. But he didn't mess up one time. I got to sit in the control room watching him play Flint Hill Special 7 times.
Oh, great.
And what didn't happen was the band didn't gel as good as it needed to, you know. Dasher didn't come in right on top of it, or maybe the rhythm wasn't tight, it sounded too loose, you know. But most of the other cuts were all first or second take.
Wow.
And if you're recording 5 songs in a day, and a couple of them go by, okay, we've got these ready, let's do these. Well, by the end of a couple hours, you've got 5 songs recorded.
Yeah.
And so you sit around and play back. Cause, you know, then the next person comes in and you did 3 songs, a couple with them. Like You Are My Flower, where Earl played the guitar. I really wanted to have him play the Carter-style guitar that he would do with the Scruggs recordings. And he knew what he was doing, and everybody, we went through it once, and Jeff and Gary Scruggs sang it, and it was perfect. Well, I mean, it was the one we kept.
Sounds perfect now. Has it really been 40 years, though?
That's an amazing thing about this. It's in its 40th year, and it's like the dark side of the moon of country music.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. I like
that. I mean, dark side of the moon helped establish a genre and identify a time with music, but it was broader than just its own period. You know how I learned more? I learned more about Dark Side of the Moon from my kids than I did from the one time I listened to the album. and I had no idea they were in the piece.
If you tell me that if you start the Will the Circle Be Unbroken is the same time as The Wizard of Oz and they match up, I'm going to lose it.
If I did what?
If you tell me that if you start up the Will the Circle Be Unbroken album at the same time that you start The Wizard of Oz, I'm going to lose it. If you tell me they match up. You ever heard this story about the Dark Side of the Moon and Wizard of Oz?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, then I made an too obscure of a reference. When we're off the air here, if you're of a mind, borrow your children's Dark Side of the Moon and start it at the same time that you start watching The Wizard of Oz. Turn The Wizard of Oz down. It's actually a track to The Wizard of Oz. I swear it is. And they finally admitted it. Anyway, that's a sideline. I'm sorry. Back to Will the Circle Be Unbroken. Let's talk about that.
Well, the thing that was neat about the circle that made it work, probably the most important aspect, was that all these people that were not us were all fans of each other. And we didn't know that. We didn't know Maybelle Carter would say, oh, Roy, I've always wanted to make a recording with you. I'm so glad we're doing this. Or that Vassar Clements would say, it's great to have my name on an album, and it's wonderful to play with Earl. And it's, you know, and or that Earl would say, I've always wanted to pick with Roy Acuff or Merle Travis or, you know, or Doc and Merle and the whole thing. It was almost like we were the activity directors.
You were the facilitators for a great... It must have been just an amazing feeling to have that occur right in front of you, because you didn't know that was going to happen.
Well, I really believe it was an event of unusual consequence. Now, of what proportion? No, we didn't... As it was coming together, it was like every day was... This is really... That was a good day. Oh, but today we've got to do Maybelle. Oh... But today we're going to do Jimmy Martin, and I'd spent years studying Jimmy Martin's albums, listening to JD and those other people, on the album.
Sure.
And trying to play that music. My brother and I used to play Jimmy Martin's songs before Bill became a manager and producer. He and I would play clubs around Southern California as a duo. And we used to do some Jimmy Martin songs. But we never did them like he did them. But now here we are, with the band from Orange County and Long Beach in the studio with the guy. And it was so good that he was so headstrong.
Well,
you had Maybell on one hand say, if you don't mind, I'd like to do a key of F. And you had Jimmy on the other hand said, it's got to be like this.
Yeah. And you're the John, right? When he says, John, you know how to play the banjo, don't you?
Yeah, because I screwed up the B intro of one of the songs. He goes, Earl never did do
that's
that.
That's right. I played that at the top of the show. That cracks me up. That's classic. That is a classic thing.
What can you say? Oh, yes, he did. No, he didn't. You're right.
Earl never did that. I heard that. That's great.
And he was a huge Earl fan for sure. And it was fun about Jimmy. You keep that five. You keep that vibe going right in my ear here when I'm singing now. You gotta get on top of me. Get on top of this, you know. But he would push people. And it was fine because he was right.
You know, I think that's the consensus is at this point, and everybody has their Jimmy Martin stories, but I think the consensus is that you put it exactly the right way. He was right about what he was trying to accomplish. He may not have been the most genteel person, but he knew what the sound, and he was right.
He was unique. And he put the color in bluegrass. He was fun. He was, one of the best singers to come down the pike. We were fortunate to be in a room with him.
Yeah. It still must give you chills.
Now, the fact that he would let you, I would say Jimmy Martin made sure everybody knew they had a right to his opinion.
Well, you talk about this event, and I've been listening to it all week to get ready for today, and your other music as well. I mean, I don't mean to slight that, but when you go back, when you start listening to the first Circle album, you almost have to listen. I do. I have to listen to the whole thing almost. I can't stop listening to it.
Yeah, it sucks you in.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
Now, the credit for that has to be given over to my brother, who's editing and concept, because we didn't have a concept for the album other than we're going to get some really good autographs and record some neat people, and record songs that we even know most of them. But as it came together, and Bill said, this album's got to be called Will the Circle Be Unbroken? Okay, and then we need to find artwork. And now I got to sequence it. Now he spent 2 months sequencing it, marrying up the conversations with the cuts, because it didn't pay to distill any reality, but just like a reality show, yes, a lot of it was real, but it was manipulated to fit in the time frame of a LP.
Oh yeah, it's a masterful cut. I mean, if when you think of the pieces put together with the audio clips where there's discussion, and even though there's noise in the background, it's perfect. It's perfect. You hear the noise in the studio. You hear Maybell talking about, can I do this? You hear other people counting off how many instruments are there in the room, and whether it's perfect.
And I will say we were very fortunate. At a time when the country was going through a lot of turmoil, we had Mr. Right Wing Roy Acuff coming in and recording with what he said were, I don't know if they're old men or young boys or what, they're all covered with hair. But it didn't stop him, nor did he make any kind of disparaging comment about anybody, other than, that sounds good.
Yeah. Wow.
We didn't know if he was going to record with us. He was scheduled for the last day, and he walked in looking kind of nonchalant or, with a real show-me attitude. Let's hear what you boys have been recording. And we played four cuts, and at the end of them, he said, now, what kind of music do you call that? And we were a little bit scared. I thought he was going to walk out. And my brother, Bill, was stumbling through, well, it's folk Appalachian, and didn't want to say hillbilly, although if he'd said it, he would have said it with respect, because, you know, it was, he didn't want to call it bluegrass, because it really wasn't solid bluegrass, yeah. You know, some what he was hearing, and he just said, why hell, it's nothing but country music, let's go make some more. And everybody cheered.
You know, go ahead.
Well, that's what he told us, his policy in the studio. Get it right the first time, and the hell with the rest of them.
There you go.
Because every time you do it again, you're going to lose something. And I tell you, Mr. Acuff was right. I have an album called String Wizards that has what I think is my finest consistent, my best I don't know if I'm any good. I know on that album I'm the best me that I could be. And playing banjo mainly, but 8 of the tracks were first takes.
Really?
It's some of the hardest music I've ever played.
Yeah, you're pretty good, John. I've heard most of that album. I've got it somewhere. I just didn't have it all in my library here, and you sent me some pieces from it. But no, you did just fine, first take or not. Let me ask you something while we're talking.
Well, I do worse.
Well, I assume you're not going to send me the worst one.
Many people do. You get up to a fifth, sixth, seventh take on something, and, oh, wait a minute. Don't you know this song? The pilot took off, he flew to Pittsburgh. He didn't go, oh, I'm sorry, we're in Detroit. You
know? Let me ask you something about the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. I was thinking this week as I was getting ready to just chat with you, and I try to think, I don't think that there's another band like them before or after. I think there's a unique spot in American music and maybe beyond that. I don't know how you, and there's no reason to classify them, you don't have to, but, I just think the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band is a unique, unique entity.
It's a very strange thing. It had a difficult name to start with, and it took 30 years for it to be accepted. But I will say that as we started and developed music, we started wanting to try to blend country and bluegrass influences with what we were doing acoustically. Jeff was picking certain types of songs. Fadden was, and Jimmy Iverson, when he was there, would have a certain influence. And we were trying to create a different sound. And at the same time, along came, a little later, came like the Burrito Brothers and the Sweethearts of the Rodeo, sure. And all that. And I'll say, I've never said this before, but they made some fine recordings, but I don't think they really believed in what they were doing. Because we did. And we kept at it.
Yeah.
We didn't do it for 3 years. We had some really down years in the 70s, you know. And then we became first American band to go to Russia in 77. That helped get publicity and actually helped get work.
Sure.
And then in 79, Jeff, we need him. Try for a pop hit. So he, Rodney Krause in this American Dream, and Jeff sang it just right. It was a top 10 pop hit.
Oh, yeah.
And he wrote Make a Little Magic. And then we said, let's go to Nashville and try to make country records, to sing some change there. Because now we can make our type of country records. And there were 18 hits.
Yeah.
18, like top 10, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, I Love Only You, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Shot Full of Love, different songs that were, Stand a Little Rain was number one.
Oh, John, it's the legacy of the Nitty, and they're not done yet. I mean, I don't want to imply that, but what you've put out there in a field that I think you stand alone in, I just don't think there's another band like Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. I've thought about it all week, and I concluded that it's you guys and then the rest of the people. But you're in an era when rock and roll is...
One thing that's never been... Well, I appreciate that. It's hard to take sometimes. But one thing that's never been said about the Circle album and the band is the group. We risked our entire career on an acoustic folk album right after we had 3 chart records.
Yeah.
What should have we done right then? We should have put out another record that was destined to follow that path of House of Two Corners, Some of Shirley Blues, Mr. Bojangles,
sure.
All 3 off of one album. The next album should have had, and here's the new whatever.
Yeah.
But instead it was like, now we gotta do this.
What were you thinking, man?
Well, it was a combination of my brother, the band, the record company, that this would be a possible, almost like extra credit.
Yeah, okay. I like that, extra credit.
Yeah, it was extra credit. You know, my term paper turned to sets. Can I do an extra credit project? And it was something that would honor the people that really gave a lot of us a background in music.
Well, I mean, you were aware, were you not? I mean, you were aware that you were trying to go back and maybe give a nod to some of those people. That was part of it, wasn't it?
Giving a more than a nod, because I got tired of people saying at colleges that we were playing because of Bojangles being hot and Unlimited Records, that we ended up playing, 150, 200 colleges a year.
Wow.
Because it was a different era. And people found, or other concerts, you know, playing Carnegie Hall with Bill Cosby. And where'd that kind of banjo playing come from? You never heard of Little Scruggs? No, who's that? You ever heard the Ballad of Jed Clampett? Well, yeah. Well, that's Earl Scruggs. You know, and you've never heard of Doc Watson? You know, this was at the tail end of the folk music scare.
Yeah.
Boom, whatever.
Yeah.
And, they'd never heard of Vassar Clements and just different people. Merle Travis was, let's put it this way. I asked Earl Scruggs, why did Flatten Scruggs do the Carter Family Tribute album in 1964? Well, Maybelle couldn't get a job in music. For 5 years, she was working as a nurse at Nashville General Hospital.
Oh, my goodness.
And so we put this album together and got her back on stage. And you know something? My brother and I made it our way to Nashville in 1965, before the Dirt Band started, just to see if we could see the Grand Ole Opry. I didn't know if it was still happening like it had been purported to be happening. You know, it didn't quite reach the West Coast. And couldn't get in because it was sold out, and I looked in that north window right when Lester Flatt said, we'd like to bring out Maybelle Carter's new Wildwood Flower.
Wow.
And it was like, I'll never meet these people, but I'm sure glad I'm here. And then I thought, I've got to. And it's a strange life I've had, you know. I'm standing there as a 19-year-old watching the Grand Ole Opry on the Ryman stage, and 40-some years later, I'm standing on the stage next to Earl Scruggs' coffin playing at his memorial.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh.
You know, it was kind of a shock. I'm looking at the same window I was looking in 45 years later.
And you're not kidding. You were actually standing outside that first time looking in the window upstairs.
The north windows. If anybody's been to the Ryman, they'll know that you can see in the stage from the north windows. Well, you can. You could then, because there was no air conditioning. And it was the middle of summer, so all the windows are open.
Wow.
People standing out there that couldn't get in watching the show.
Hey, John, tell the story. And I want to play one of your tunes here, but I want you, while we're talking about Earl, which we could talk about forever, tell the story about his comments to you. I believe you were at Vanderbilt. And we talked about this the other day, but tell that story. I love that story. When he came up to you, the Dirt Band was playing in Vanderbilt, and Earl came up and made some comments about your play.
I don't say this arrogantly, but I will say it. I was proud of the fact that when I asked Earl Scruggs, why did you come see the band? You know, you brought your whole family, but why did you come? And he said, I just wanted to meet the boy that played Randy Jim Rag the way I intended to.
Yeah.
And that was me, and that was quite a shock. And I was, it was better than getting a Grammy.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful thing. It's a nice thing to say.
That's something that just you can't replace that, and especially if you're playing banjo and Earl's there,
I played as good as I could that night. I don't know what he said after. Oh, he wasn't that good, actually.
Why don't we? I've got a couple of your tunes here. Since we're talking about Earl. Do you want to play a cut that you did of Ground Speed, and then we'll come back and chat? I want to talk to you about, I know you're writing a book, and I know you're on the radio, and you got a lot of things, but why don't we play a tune for folks out there? And
if you, nice.
Can we play Ground
this
Speed?
Is fun. This is one of my favorite Earl tunes. This is Ground Speed, where it's, it was one take, and it's Jerry Douglas on dobro, Sam Bush on mandolin, Josh Graves on, Josh Graves on dobro.
Okay.
Because I tried to get Josh on the Circle album, but he called me a few days before the session and said, John, I don't know what to tell you, but I'm working for Lester, and Lester told me as long as I'm on his payroll, he doesn't want me picking with Earl.
Oh, jeepers.
Isn't okay. that weird?
All right, let's play John. We're talking to John McHugh, and this is Steve Martin's on Real Bluegrass, and I'm having a blast. But let's show these folks, John, what kind of a banjo picker you are. And I think this Ground Speed cut is just a great one. So let's throw that out there for a second, okay? Hold on.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah, John.
I'm trying to see if I can actually hear you.
Yeah, John, John McHugh is still on the phone. We were talking off the air, and I went to play Ground Speed, and then we were talking about some issues with music and what John is doing, and I went ahead and clicked on Carolina Traveler because we'd set up Ground Speed pretty good, I think, John. And then,
what a nice guy.
And then Carolina Traveler, I know, is special to you because you recorded that with Earl Scruggs, I think.
Well, not just that. As I'm recording with Earl, I was putting together the String Wizards album, my first album on Vanguard, my actual first album away from Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. And I woodshed it. I practiced for 2 months straight and then got together with all the pickers. But I didn't get a chance to get together with Earl until the day before, 2 days before. And I said, Earl, I'd like to do a Frailing thing, like on the Circle album. Like we did Soldier's Joy together and have Roy Husky play the bass. So it's the same bass that Junior Husky, his father, used on the Circle album.
Oh, yeah.
It's the same Uncle Dave Macon banjo that I used on the Circle album for Soldier's Joy. And it's the same banjo that Earl used on the Circle album to play one of his songs called Carolina Traveler, him being from North Carolina.
Yeah.
And it seemed appropriate. So I go out to Earl's house, and there's Roy and me and Earl. And I'm learning the song so I can get on top of his notes with the Frailing, you know, with the different syncopations and stuff. We go through it about 5 times, and Roy is just standing there stuffing the tobacco in his pipe, leaning on his bass. He hasn't played a note. And Earl and I go through it. After about the 5th time, Earl says, Roy, are you going to pick? And Roy says, I'm working on it, Earl. I'm working on it. And you do it one more time. And we did it one more time. And then the next time he played the most perfect bass part for that song on Carolina Traveler, because with 3 instruments, to keep the arrangement interesting, it really has to be broken down. You know, you can't just everybody start at the beginning and finish and go to full board at the end. His bass part was so intelligently thought out. And then, okay, we went through it 2 times with Roy, and then we met in the studio the next day. We got our sounds on the instruments. Everything said, okay, let's record it. Here we go. And at the end of the 1st take, I said to the engineer, I said, how's it? He said, everything's good. And I said, well, should we do it one more time? And Earl says, well, I don't reckon why. What was wrong with that? I said, well, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that I don't get you in the band very often.
You just wanted him to stick around for a while.
I just wanted to do it again live, you know. and we didn't. It's just the 1 take. And Roy was, it was all fun. And then we did the other version of Cripple Creek, that actually did a spaced out version of Cripple Creek. Being one of the first Scrug songs that really got me, you know. Right. One of the first of several.
Isn't that the first one we all learned, though?
Yeah, it is for sure.
Yeah.
Almost the Louie of bluegrass.
Yeah, that's good. And still though, John, nobody plays it like Earl, even though we all try.
That's a fact. He definitely had a sound. And there's not very many people that play a form of music that ends up having their name attached to it.
That's right. You know? That's right. He's.
I really think if Bill Monroe had thought a little further ahead, he would have called it Bill Monroe and the Monroe Grass Boys. Or something. And that way all bluegrass would be called Monroe.
Monroe Grass. Oh, I got you. Okay.
Yeah, you play that Monroe music? Yeah. Because if you play Travis-style guitar,
that's right. And you play Scruggs, everybody plays Scruggs style. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, John, somebody asked, and I want to get to this in a minute. I think you're working on a book, are you not?
I have been for many years, but I finally have gotten a great literary agent that is in the process of finding the publisher, somebody that is in the pretty high up on the book chain. And it'll probably be next year sometime.
And it's going to be about?
You know, that's a good question. It's about the life that I've gone through, but it's not an autobiography. It's more about the people that I've run into.
Okay.
My viewpoint, I feel like I've been a voyeur in my own life, you know, watching things happen. I mean, how many people have been in the dressing room with Eddie Van Halen and Bob Dylan both getting ready to go on at the same time with their backs to each other? Bob fumbling with his harp rack and Eddie hammering the guitar. And then I took my banjo and played Foggy Mountain Breakdown really fast for about 10 seconds. And then said, hey, you guys want to play bluegrass? Because they didn't know who the F I was or what I was doing. They knew what they did, you know?
I would say probably you're the only one.
Well, they both turned and looked at each other for the first time and kind of shrugged their shoulders and went back to what they were doing. I didn't want to tell Bob Dylan then, but maybe he'll find out. I wanted to say thanks for the banjo, and he wouldn't know what I meant, but when I was 19, I borrowed $2,000 to promote a Bob Dylan concert at a high school in Long Beach, and it sold out. I made enough to buy a new master tone.
That's right. I read that. Yeah.
And so, thanks, Bob, for the banjo.
Well, I think when you get your book done, you have to dedicate it to Bob for the first nice banjo that you had.
It got stolen in Miami.
Yeah.
Ten days before the Circle album.
That, you know, and the unusual thing about that is, the old joke is if you leave a banjo in the car unlocked, you'll wake up in the morning and there'll be like two or three of them there. It's surprising that someone would find your banjo and take it from you.
Especially in 1970. Come on, they didn't even know what it was.
Yeah. Oh, man. And you've talked about, and I know that you have the String Wizard. We've talked about Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, which I still think we could talk about them forever. I just think it's an unparalleled collection of an history of music. But John, you play banjo. We've talked about you play fiddle. You play guitar. You are clearly very talented multi-instrumentalist. I don't want people that are listening to this show just think you're just a banjo player. You're not.
I'm more of a banjo guitar player. Fiddle, I work at constantly, but I'll never have it the way, you know, I mean, I've been very lucky. I've recorded with Sam Bush playing fiddle, Stuart Duncan, Byron Berline, Kenny Baker. No, I haven't recorded with them. I played with them. But Bobby Hicks, Phil Salazar, he's a West Coast fiddle player.
Yeah.
All kinds of great players. And I know that I'll never get there.
Well.
But I'm okay with what I do. I work at it. And I like playing a few fiddle tunes I know. And being the guy that plays the fiddle in the Dirt Band. And, but as far as actual accomplishment, I like what I do on the guitar as far as something that I can listen to. And hopefully other people.
Well, let's talk about a minute. We know you're working on the book and it's going to be about that big broad topic of John McEwen, musical voyeur. Maybe that'll be the title. I don't know if you have a working title.
I don't know what the title is. It might be What the Fluck Happened.
Okay, that or Musical Voyeur. And if you want to use Musical Voyeur, you can have it. I'll just give it to you on the air. You can have it. But, and you have several of them. We talked about String Wizards, but let's talk about the albums that John McEwen has put his name on, as, you know, this is my album as opposed to Nitty Gritty Dirt Band?
Well, String Wizards and String Wizards 2 are I'm very proud of, and after that was Acoustic Traveler, which is what I named my XM radio show after with the hopes that it would bring attention to the album.
Yeah.
I'm up to about 42 units now on the album, so another 5 years of the Acoustic Traveler show might make it to 100 units. But, yeah, it's actually one of my best reviewed as far as musical, as far as original compositions and playing, the Acoustic Traveler album, and it's more guitar with banjo taking the secondary role. That was for the full group of players.
Okay.
And then there's a live album called Round Trip, which features a really good group of players, two different live shows that are cut together into one, with my son Jonathan. And then one I'm most proud of, or certainly proud of, is the McEwen Sessions, which is my son Nathan and my son Jonathan, the three of us making an album, which we did last year.
Wow. And what kind of, is it the same kind of music we would expect that you to be playing on, or what are you doing?
It's music that I told them, let's each one of us pick three songs that we want the other two to play on, and then we'll pick three together that we have to agree on, so there's a dozen songs. And the two players have had influences from the Dirt Band to Fish to Rush to whatever, and so there's a wide combination of things. It's acoustic mainly, and we do all the playing. But so if you put that together, another album I'm particularly proud of is the one with Martha Redbone, which is called The Roots Project, The Songs of William Blake. You know who William Blake was?
Yeah. Well, I know who you're talking
about. For those that don't know, the British poet William Blake in 1804 through 1815, 20 or so, wrote some incredible lyrics, and Martha and I put them to melodies. And she sang the crap out of them. She really is a great singer. Martha Redbone, no relation to Leon.
I was going to ask you, but no.
Yeah. And, Martha's, the Native American half mix, and, we did that album with, the idea of, what would happen if William Blake had grown up in Appalachia and around dulcimers, banjos, fiddles, mandolins, and stuff? And if he'd written music for his album called Songs of Love, or Garden of Love, or something like that. William Blake was basically he was like the Jim Morrison of the 1800s. A lot of his artwork looks like it could be in Marvel Comics, and be comfortable. Huh. His lyrics were so far ahead. There's people like Tom Hanks and Johnny Depp are both big fans of William Blake's writing. And Martha delivered it quite well. And I'm particularly proud of the Steve Martin album, The Crow. Which
I was not going to let you get away without talking about your efforts with that album. Talk about that a little bit.
What would you like to know?
Well, first of all, we all know that you know Steve and have known for years and years and years. But then when Steve came back, wanted to get back into playing again, he chose you to produce that album, The Crow, right?
Well, I kind of convinced him that he needed to have one producer that knew his background and knew how to meld the influences that we both had, because we both started playing at the same time.
Yeah.
In high school and on and so forth. And when we were working in Disneyland time period. And I knew that we had some of the same taste, which means Appalachian Spring by Aaron Copland, The Music Man, Disneyland, David Lindley, and Fat and Scruggs, and Doug Dillard. Doug Dillard was probably the main reason I'm talking to you, is because I saw them play one night when I was just playing guitar, and I went, what was that? He walked on stage and played Hickory Hollow fast and perfect.
Yeah.
And just took everybody's breath away. And they were great. This is in the middle 60s before the Dirt Band. So taking those influences and putting together and having them be an overview of what I thought his music would be so he would like it, I said, Steve, what's important is you need to like this music, the end product. And I think your melodies are strong enough that people will like them, but they, some of them need to be framed differently. This isn't bluegrass. And it's really good. He has so little confidence in his music that it picks up. It was really exciting.
He writes such strong melodies, I think. I mean, I enjoy his playing, and I like him as a person, but I think his melodies are really just fine.
I thought Picking County Turnaround, I told him when he wrote that, I said, I wish I'd written, oh, you're just saying that. I said, no, that's a great band.
It is a great band.
But Picking County Turnaround was written in 1972.
Yeah.
And then they started pulling out a little more. And ended up winning a Grammy. Hooray!
Now you can't get him off the stage.
It was really good working with him. He really loves to play the banjo.
Well, now you can't get him off the stage with a banjo. I think everywhere you see him, he's got a banjo.
Yeah.
Talk about your XM radio show. I knew that, and I wanted to ask you about that. You mentioned a little bit about Acoustic Traveler, but how long have you been doing radio?
I think it's the seventh year.
Wow.
And, it's basically a show that's on both the bridge and then broadcast. They run it six times a month. I do one a month, and they run it six times.
Okay.
And, two different stations, or, whatever you call it. So one's a station and one's internet. And it's basically the other side. I only play people that I know or that I've met or recorded with. And I haven't run out yet.
Well, I was going to say, you've...
Fun. And that also includes some street performers that I run into, or maybe like one time there was a band that was busking. We were doing 20 cities with Willie Nelson in Canada, and this bluegrass band was out in the front of the building playing for the line. They'd followed the show around. So I went out and sat in with them a couple times and got one of their albums and put it on my show.
Wow. That's a great thing. That's a great thing to give some exposure like
that. I don't know if it does anybody any good and, you know, whatever, but it's fun. It's fun to get exposure. There's a lot of great new people out there. But mainly it's talking about, here's something I recorded at Leon Russell's house in 1995, when it was after midnight, and then play something else that Leon Russell, I think I played something I recorded at his house in Tulsa after that one, which was with the Dirt Band, where he had his first house was in Nashville, and I said, well, let's go back 20 years, or maybe play something that I recorded in my house in Laurel Canyon, like Kenny Loggins at 19 doing Danny's song. Or tell a story about John Denver and play one of his cuts.
You see, folks, this is why I was so excited to have John on, John McEwen. John, to me, you are, if there's a figure that runs in and out, and you've listed all these different kinds of music and all these people, you are a common thread through so much of the music that I've listened to my entire life and still listen to today. I just think you have I think your book is going to be great if you can put all those things into some sort of a written form. It's just a phenomenal thing that you've gone through.
It is very strange, and I'm very appreciative of it. And I'm very thankful for the Dirt Band fans or people such as yourself, because I think I do have a story to tell about what was going on with Greg Allman between the success of the Allman Brothers and the non-success and then the re-success. You know, or what happened when they started and before they started, you know, things that people that I'm shocked that I sometimes when I look at the list that, yeah, I actually asked Tom Petty if he'd record with us and he said yes. Well, how did you do that? Well, he was down the studio, down the hall in a different studio, and we were recording Willie Nelson doing Goodnight Irene, and I walked into Tom Petty's studio and said, excuse me, you don't know me, but would you like to sing Goodnight Irene with Willie Nelson? He goes, well, yeah. I said, well, come down the hall.
You got to ask.
And why not?
You got to ask.
Ray Acuff said yes.
Yeah. John, I would like to play another tune here. I love this Return to Dismal Swamp and set up the people on this, because this is not a bad cast either.
This is one of the first tunes that I wrote. It's in a G minor, for those that are taking notes. It's Sam Bush, Jerry Douglas, Stuart Duncan, Roy Husky, and David Greer. And I'm playing banjo, but an addition that I really think is part of something I try to get whenever I can is David Hoffner, who is a keyboard player in the Nashville area that I work with when I can. He's worked on the Martha Redbone album, and we did a film score for a couple times for different things and together. David plays banjo and hammered dulcimer and keyboards, so he understands the way to mix them all together, at least in the way that I like. Mm. And this is Return to Dismal Swamp.
Great tune, and John.
Dismal Swamp was the first place in Northern Virginia, Northeastern Virginia, that George Washington had his first job was surveying Dismal Swamp. And Dismal Swamp was a land grab. It was a real estate thing, like buy some swamp land. It's going to be worth something. Never happened. Because the islands of Dismal Swamp have a habit of floating around because they aren't really islands. So that's the setup for that.
We're going to play this tune from John McEwen, who's nice enough to call into the show, Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass. John, you just have a hard time getting sidemen together, but we're going to play this anyway with the cast that you've got. We're going to listen to Return to Dismal Swamp. So hold on, we'll be back in like 3 minutes and 23 seconds. All right, that was a great tune, Return to Dismal Swamp. You heard John McEwen, who's still on the phone, set that whole deal up. And now we're back on the air with John. And, John, I've loved it. We gave an hour for it. I'd do 5 hours if you ever wanted to come back and I could just talk to you forever. And I have absolutely had a blast. I appreciate this so much.
Same here. Like I said to my mom, thanks for having me.
Well, tell about your website and where you're touring about right now that I want to end the show with.
Mom thought about my mom made up my website name. It's John McEwen. I added .com.
You added
.com. One of the problems is it's hard to spell McEwen.
Yeah.
But just Google John Nitty Gritty. If you can't find me, unless it pops up pretty good.
Yeah, you can find John McEwen. Google it. You'll find his website. He's got pictures. He's got videos. He's got bits of stories. I did steal that one video that you kind of did. That's on your Facebook page, and I reposted it on mine. That's a neat little 5 or 6 minute video about John. So he's easy to find him. And I asked him when we were off the air if we could talk a little bit more. And then what I want to do is get out of here with again from that "Will the Circle Be Unbroken." There's three of them. The first one I keep talking about. I don't mean to slight the others, but I want to get out of here today with the title cut, "Will the Circle Be Unbroken?" If that's okay with you.
That's fine.
All right. John, anything else?
Marty Stewart drugged me I didn't know where I was going, but I said, where are we going? And you'll figure it out. And it was the last week of Lester Flatt doing the Martha White Hour.
Oh. Yeah.
And in the middle of it, Lester goes, we have a young man here who's going to pick a banjo right after this commercial. And Marty... It was me. I didn't know he'd set it up. So but when we got out of commercial, Lester says, what number would you like to pick? And the only thing I could think of was, well, how about Earl's Breakdown? And he goes, that's a fine number.
Well, it is a fine number. Of course, you got to have the tuners ready.
It was like 15 years after Earl and Lester had played together, Anyway, so I'll say the same thing to you about what's a fine number.
It's a fine number. All right, John McEwen, this, again, please, I appreciate you arranging this. I'd love to have you back, and we can talk about some other things or just keep doing what we're doing now. I hope you've enjoyed the time, and I hope you'll come back sometime.
Yeah, I hope you've enjoyed the time. Yes, I have. Thank you, Steve.
Yeah.
You just made me think of an old Groucho Marx quote, which doesn't apply to this evening.
Okay. I know what you're talking about. I understand.
You know the one?
Yes,
I
did.
A perfectly wonderful evening, but this wasn't it.
That's right. You're right. I'm just throwing softballs to you now, John, at this point. You just keep whacking me all over the place. We'll get back together. And for the folks listening, by the way, John's interview if it's a good way to keep track of this show, there's a website now that's popped up, unrealbluegrass.com. John's interview, as well as Jeff Stelling's from earlier in the day, will probably be placed on that website within a week or so, and you can listen to all the great stories that John told and Jeff Stelling told about using propellers to design a banjo rim, which was cool. I didn't know that, but we're going to get out of here and thank Jeff Stelling and thank John McEwen for participating, and I've enjoyed the heck out of it, and you're going to hear a classic, Will the Circle Be Unbroken, from that same album that we've been talking about all day.
Thank you, and I'll talk to you down the road.
All right, John, I definitely want to talk to you again, all right?
Yes, sir.
All right, man, see you, bye.
Bye.